Sea Grant, and Lake Superior, sustaining the freshwater sea. A production of the University of Wisconsin Sea Grant Institute. Shipwrecks, archaeologists, and unholy apostles. Thanks to the songwriting skills of Gordon Lightfoot, what many Americans probably think of first when they hear of Lake Superior is the famous wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald in 1974. Shipwrecks hold an undeniable fascination for most people, and the lake has indeed claimed many vessels over the years. A good number of those ships foundered amidst the Apostle Islands, earning them the name Unholy Apostles in some quarters. But as Superior is a frigid freshwater sea, ships that go down in its waters do not suffer the same fate as those lost on the high seas. The unusual properties of Lake Superior in this regard have led to its shipwrecks becoming a remarkable historical and economic asset to the region. And I went to speak with two underwater archaeologists who work with the University of Wisconsin Sea Grant to help explain why.
I'm Tamara Thompson. I'm a maritime archaeologist with the Wisconsin Historical Society.
Keith Meverden. I'm a maritime archaeologist with the Wisconsin Historical Society.
Why do you love working on shipwrecks?
There's always something to learn about shipwrecks. Every time you go there, it's a mystery as far as what went down. A lot of times the shipwrecks, they're time capsules. They went down with everything that the crew would have had aboard with them at the time of their loss. And so they really give you a place and time history of what it was like to work on the Great Lakes and the things that they would have brought with them.
And why is Lake Superior such an unusual place for shipwrecks of this type?
Lake Superior is really unique in the world for historic shipwrecks because the level of preservation that we find in the wrecks on Lake Superior, you can dive a shipwreck that has been laying on the bottom for over 100 years and still see the name painted on the vessel and still see a lot of the crew's effects, the tools they were working with. All this is extremely well preserved, and it's mostly due to the cold, fresh water of Lake Superior. After you get below 100 feet, rarely in the summertime do you get water temps above 40 degrees, if ever. The cold, fresh water, it just does a fantastic job of preserving the wrecks because we don't have a lot of the salt water that's really corrosive to wrecks in the ocean environment or a lot of the marine organisms that you find in saltwater environments. Those are absent from Lake Superior, so they're not working to deteriorate the wrecks very quickly. Sea Grant has been a very important partner of the Wisconsin Historical Society almost since the inception of the Wisconsin Historical Society's Maritime Archaeology Program in 1988. Since that time, Sea Grant has been an important partner of ours and was really one of the first Sea Grant programs in the nation to fund and sponsor underwater archaeology and cultural resource work. They've been a stalwart partner with us since that time. They continue to be so. And it's really been a model for a lot of other programs.
When people think about diving destinations, coral reefs usually come to mind. But Wisconsin has blossomed into a diving hotspot in the last few years.
We have quite a few groups that are coming now into Wisconsin to dive our shipwrecks. We've seen groups from Germany, from England, from Japan in recent years coming to explore the different wrecks because of the level of preservation that they have. And so it is becoming more and more popular as far as tourism and drawing people into the area to look at the shipwrecks by diving. But then you can also see them by boat. You can see a lot of them by kayak. They're relatively shallow. Or you can snorkel them and enjoy them just from the surface.
The crew jumped off on that dock right over there that you see. They cut the lines, and the Ottawa floated over here and burned to the bottom.
The dock. It's over there.
Oh, okay. And just ahead of us again is the Coffinberry. It's been sitting here since 1912. Once we get past this portion of the wreckage that I can't drive over, we'll be close enough that you can actually see the metal steering gear and the rudder assemblies of the Coffinberry as well. If you're on the top deck or on the bow, you can actually see the ribs of the Ottawa directly out here that we're unable to pass over. Alrighty, we're only about 10 feet from poking in here, so if you get ready, you'll see the other portion of the wreckage.
When it comes to the shipwrecks, What do you do in your job?
We do what's called phase two archaeological surveys. So we look at the shipwreck in place. A lot of times we document what's down there. We want to leave as many artifacts in place as possible because that is one of the tourist draws. The more cool stuff that remains with the shipwreck, the more people want to come and visit it. And so we can promote tourism that way. There's been sort of an evolution in wreck divers in this area since the Abandoned Shipwreck Act took effect in 1987. It used to be where everything would be taken off the shipwreck. There was sort of this hungry diver looking for brass, any kind of artifact to bring up with them. And it took a little bit of time, but now the divers really do respect that what's left with the wrecks, a lot of times it's a grave site. A lot of times we can learn things from the artifacts and the place that they are or they remain on the bottom. And so they'll leave them alone and just take pictures and then encourage other people to leave artifacts in place and to just take pictures. It's illegal to remove the items, but also moving them around the site has become discouraged by a lot of people.
For the archaeological surveys that we do, we don't actually do a full-scale excavation like a lot of people think of when they think of archaeology. We document everything on the bottom as it lies in place. We don't disturb the bottom, the shipwreck, or the artifacts. We don't pull things up out of the mud and the sediment. We document everything that's visible. We learned about the different construction features, any of the cultural artifacts that might be left, things that the crew members were using. Not only what they are, but where they're located on the wreck can tell us a lot of information, because typically on an old schooner, officers, their cabins would be in the aft end of the vessel, and the regular crew members would be up at the forward end. Now, where we find different artifacts on the wreck itself can tell us a lot of information. That's why one of the reasons we discouraged a lot of divers from moving artifacts about the site. Because one popular thing is, you know, if you find a couple cool things in different places on the wreck, somebody will move them all in together into one place to get a good photograph of all of them together. But you're really destroying a lot of the information that we can glean from those artifacts by moving them around. So we document everything in place as it lies, and we leave it down there for everyone to enjoy and see.
On the evening of Monday, November 15th, 1886, the schooner Lucerne set sail from Ashland, Wisconsin, bound for her home port of Cleveland. Strong and sleek, the 190-foot vessel had taken on a cargo of 1,200 tons of iron ore for its last run of the year. She could have held 100 tons more, but Captain George Lloyd was experienced and wary of overloading the ship in case of heavy seas. Though it was late in the season, a fair wind was blowing, the barometer was high, and the big schooner, considered one of the sturdiest on the lake, had just been refitted with new canvas. The winds picked up considerably after they left Shawamigan Bay, but they sailed on through the night. At dawn, they found themselves in the teeth of a vicious winter gale. The three-day blizzard that struck Superior in the Upper Peninsula that year was one of the worst northeasters on record, with blinding sleet and snow driven by hurricane-force winds. The Lucerne struggled on up the Michigan coast all that day. She was spotted by the skipper of another embattled ship, the Fred Kelly, around 4 p.m., quote, rolling and pitching about on the lake, evidently at the mercy of wind and waves, unquote. The Fred Kelly's mate reported that the Lucerne put about at nightfall, apparently heading back for the relative safety of Shawamigan Bay. And she almost made it. What happened next was long a mystery, for the Lucerne was not seen again till Friday morning, November 19th. She had bottomed out in shallow water off Long Island near the entrance of the bay.
The archaeological work that we did on the Lucerne site really filled in a lot of the gaps from the historic story of the Lucerne and its loss. What happened between the time they left Ashland and the time that they found the vessel sunk off Long Island, really nobody knew. It was all speculation until we went out and actually started looking at the site and doing the archaeological documentation. A couple clues really kind of jumped out. It had a broken keelson around the center board. The anchors were out. It was facing into the wind. It was in very shallow water, just under 20 feet of water. The windlass, the winch that raises and lowers the anchor and the anchor chains, had an iron bar stuck into it, and it was stuck underneath the anchor chain running through the windlass. If you put all of those things together, it fills in a lot of the blanks. What we think happened in the final moments is the captain turned around just off the Keweenaw. That was where they last sighted by another vessel out on Lake Superior. And in a blinding snowstorm, he tried to make the entrance to Shawamigan Bay, try to escape the very large waves on Lake Superior. And in a blinding snowstorm, feeling your way into an entrance that's a little less than a mile wide is not very easy. It's pretty difficult without radar, GPS, or everything we have in the modern era. They were getting into really shallow water. They weren't certain where they were, so they dropped their anchor and tried to ride out the storm, but unfortunately their anchor started dragging, and as they got into shallow water, the boat started pounding. Then they tried to pull their anchors up and get back out to sea, but they were so coated in ice that they couldn't get their anchors up, and they're trying to free the windlass. And during that time, that's when they actually sank and climbed up the mast and rigging to try to escape the waves.
No one on the crew survived. The next day, the Ashland Press reported that the three men who had lashed themselves to the rigging to avoid drowning were covered in 1 to 6 inches of ice, and that, quote, the balance of the shipmates still remain on the wreck or have been swept out into the lake, which seldom ever gives up its dead, unquote. One man was only 21 years old and was eventually identified as the son of a well-known lake captain. The press reported the following week that, quote, it was his son's first trip on the Lucerne, and as it proved, his last earthly voyage, unquote. Have you dived the Lucerne?
Yes. It's actually a very nice shipwreck, very shallow, clear water typically. There's a lot to see when you go down there. It's just off the end of Long Island and the Apostle Islands. It's very easy to reach by boat. We have volunteers that will put out a temporary mooring that was sponsored by UWC Grant every year. And so it's very easy to find if you're going there by boat or by kayak.
Is it a popular dive site?
It is. It's one of the most popular in the Apostle Islands. So there's a couple charters that go out to it. So it's very easy if you don't have your own boat to get out to and get access to as well.
I imagine people listening to this are probably thinking, how cool is that? You get to go diving and you get to be an archaeologist. Talk about sexy jobs of the future, underwater archaeology. When did underwater archaeology really take off?
The field of underwater archaeology really began in the Mediterranean Sea in the 1960s. George Bass is one of the very early archaeologists that made a name for himself in underwater archaeology. And from there, it's really grown, especially in the last decade or two. It's gotten a lot of attention, and mostly because people have really realized the importance of the archaeological resources. Not to say that this isn't a fun job. We get to go to dive shipwrecks and see a lot of really cool things on the bottom. But a lot of people are starting to realize the importance of these wrecks, not only from what they can tell us and what we can learn about the past from these shipwrecks, but also at an economic level for tourism and boost to the local economies around the state. In the last several years, it's kind of a coming of age for underwater archaeology. It's an acknowledged field within anthropology. We have a lot of state programs within the U.S. We also have several federal programs. NOAA has its own underwater archaeology program along with the National Park Service. 30 years ago, underwater resources were neglected, and that's really not the case anymore.
What are your hopes for the work that you're doing? What inspires you? What makes you go, yeah, this is cool?
A lot of the shipwreck surveys that we do culminate in listings on the National Register of Historic Places. Right now, we're just shy of 50 shipwreck sites in Wisconsin waters that are listed on this National Register of Historic Places, and that's far more than any other state in the nation. One, that's a testament to the great state of preservation that we have in the Great Lakes and also the importance of the collection that we have in Wisconsin waters. And the fact that we have so many shipwreck sites listed on the National Register is a testament to how important these are, what they say about our past. Today, in the modern era, a lot of people think of the water as an obstacle. If you want to drive from Wisconsin to Michigan, one, you either have to take a ferry over the lake or you have to drive all the way around the lake, which takes forever. Whereas 100 years ago, it was completely different. Water was the highway. That's how you got around. We didn't have the interstate systems. Before the 1850s, we didn't even have the railroad systems. If you wanted to travel over land, you're talking horse and carriage or by foot, long, tedious travel, and it was not easy. But on the water, it's easy to move a boat, especially, you know, sail power, wind power. You can move very large, bulky, heavy cargoes very easily. The rivers and the lakes are the highways of yesteryear.
You can see in this office there are diagrams of many shipwrecks. Some of them hit the bottom and break into a million pieces, and some of them are relatively intact. What does that tell us about the ships when you go down and see this?
When the ships remain together and intact, it means that they sank very slowly. Usually when you look at them, the cabins may have blown off because of pressure that's built up within the hull as it's sinking. But if they go down relatively slowly, you're pretty guaranteed to have an intact hull on the bottom. Again, that depends a lot on what they were carrying. The shipwrecks on Lake Superior, a lot of them were carrying iron ore. When you discover those, no matter really how quickly they went to the bottom, they look like fillet of shipwreck on the bottom. They're broken up everywhere because of the weight of the cargo that they were carrying.
Also, the water depth plays an important role in how intact a wreck is, because even if a ship sank slowly and completely intact, if it's only in 20 or 30 feet of water, you're in the surf zone and it's a very dynamic environment. A shipwreck is on the bottom for 100 years. It's 100 years of storms and waves and surge and surf, and it's just literally continuously pounding the shipwreck to pieces. But the deeper you go, the more intact you will find the shipwrecks, because the deeper water, it's not a dynamic environment. Its temperature is stable. It doesn't fluctuate a lot, but it's not affected by storm surge or surf. So that's why we find a really high state of preservation in Lake Superior, because it's the deepest of the Great Lakes at just over 1,300 feet. The next deepest Great Lake is Lake Michigan at just over 950. So that's why we find an incredible state of preservation, just because of the depth, the cold, and the very stable environments that these wrecks are in.
I was up on Lake Superior, and the ship captain told a cryptic tale of finding preserved bodies of the sailors at the bottom of the lakes. Is this a tall tale?
Unfortunately, no. Because of the low oxygen levels very deep in the lake, a lot of the bodies actually what's called soapify. Your body fat basically turns to soap, and you remain kind of a skeleton of yourself, but made of just the body fat. And a lot of the shipwrecks that are very deep, the bodies will still have clothes on them. They'll be recognized as human beings laying there on the bottom. So we really do have to respect a lot of these wrecks as gravesites. I know, gruesome.
Now, you could tell they're wearing the clothing of the period. So there's more than just ship construction you can learn when you go to these sites, correct?
Oh, yes. You can learn a lot about what the crew would have had with them, what they would have been wearing. All of that is there on the bottom for us to observe and look at.
I'm sure that the people listening are all raring to go dive a few shipwrecks in Superior themselves, but they should always remember a couple things.
Check the weather before you go and make sure you have enough life preservers aboard. Just kidding. If you are going to dive Lake Superior, it is important to watch the weather. Storms pick up very quickly on the lake. If you are going to take up diving, make sure that you're certified. So it's very easy to get certifications. Almost every large town and small town has a scuba instructor in it, so take the time to do that. It might be worth your while to take a look at the WisconsinShipwrecks.org website and learn the history of the wreck. A lot of the wrecks in Lake Superior, the site plans are there, so you will be able to benefit from looking at that website and being able to identify what you're going to look at when you see things on the bottom.
What are some of the more unusual things that you have seen diving these wrecks in Lake Superior?
I don't think a lot of people understand how well the shipwrecks are preserved in Lake Superior. A lot of what we see in the media is warm tropical sites in the ocean that are completely encrusted in coral. You see some vague shapes that might be a cannon, but you can't really tell. If you dive a wreck on Lake Superior, as you're descending down the mooring line that connects your dive boat to the shipwreck, you're coming down that line, and you're descending through the water column, and the ambient light is kind of going away, and you're getting deeper, and all of a sudden you see this wreck looming out of the gloom below you. It looks like it could literally bring it to the surface, pump the water out, and float it away. It's that well preserved. It's literally like somebody plucked these ships off the surface 100 years ago and deposited them on the bottom. The Wisconsin Historical Society's Maritime Archaeology Program is really still in existence due to University of Wisconsin Sea Grant partnerships. You know, the funding, the public outreach, the websites. No matter what we do, Sea Grant is always there to help us along, to help promote what we do, and to help further the knowledge and education of the importance of the shipwrecks within Wisconsin.
All right, I'm going to let these guys get back in the water. We will talk to everyone else soon. Till next time.